During the many relief visits I paid that winter in tenement houses and miserable lodgings, I was constantly shadowed by a certain sense of shame that I should be comfortable in the midst of such distress. This resulted at times in a curious reaction against all the educational and philanthropic activities in which I had been engaged. In the face of the desperate hunger and need, these could not but seem futile and superficial. The hard winter in Chicago had turned the thoughts of many of us to these stern matters. A young friend of mine who came daily to Hull House consulted me in regard to going into the paper warehouse belonging to her father, that she might there sort rags with the Polish girls. Another young girl took a place in a sweatshop for a month, doing her work so simply and thoroughly that the proprietor had no notion that she had not been driven there by need. Still two others worked in a shoe factory. And all this happened before such adventures were undertaken in order to procure literary material. That's an excerpt from Jane Addams' 20 Years at Hull House. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
In 1931, Jane Addams became the first American woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize, an achievement honoring her efforts in creating settlement houses and advocating for women's rights and international peace. Joining us to explore the life and work of Jane Addams is Judith Sikora, lecturer in the School of Social Work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Well, first, I suppose we should tell those who might not know that it's Addams with two D's.
Yes.
In case you want to look this figure up on one source or another. And Jane Addams, although a Nobel laureate, an American, and one from not too far from Wisconsin, still largely an unknown figure for many people, I venture to say, even those probably who know something about the history of social work in the United States. So we should begin with where she came from.
Well, as you said, Jane Addams was born very near Wisconsin. She was born in Cedarville, Illinois in 1860, so right before the Civil War. And her father was very influential in Cedarburg. He was a farmer. He was a miller. He became a politician. He had been an abolitionist. He was a great admirer of Abraham Lincoln. And there were always plenty of books in the Addams household, and he really believed that his children should be well-educated, including his girl children. Jane's mother died when she was 2.5 years old, and her father didn't remarry until about 7 years later. So she had a lot of time with her father, even, and then she was the youngest also. She always seemed to know that she wanted to do something really important with her life.
Well, it seems, I don't know, when I think about her, I don't think of someone born in 1860.
No.
She seems much more modern than that. 1860 to be born at that point with the Civil War to come and such a long time ago in terms of attitudes toward women. Besides her father being sort of unconventional, what else do you see in her early life that would help to explain how she became such an unconventional, strong, and pioneering figure?
I think part of it was when she went to Rockford Seminary for Women, which is now Rockford College. It was a very stimulating intellectual atmosphere, and she was free to study a lot of things, although the school expected a lot of those young women to go on to be missionaries, and that's something that did not at all interest Jane Addams. Her stepmother also was very well educated, and after college, they went to Europe for a long visit in Europe, and she was trying to decide what it was she wanted to do with her life. I don't know if because of her father that she had this really independent streak and this sort of social justice already in her, but she definitely did not want to be a missionary, and she didn't want to be a teacher. She didn't want to take up those traditional educational or employment opportunities for women, and she just went through, I think, a lot of inner turmoil, because she talks about it a little bit in 20 Years at Hull House. She was valedictorian of her class. She was president of her class. She was editor of the school magazine. And she was a great debater. And I think that in her last trip to Europe and going and meeting young people her age at Toynbee Hall in London, I think had a big influence on her. But also just going around the world and meeting people who were different, I think that made a big difference in her life, too.
What about religious background?
You know, Jane Addams is often referred to as a Quaker, but she doesn't refer to herself as a Quaker. And in her biographies, I've looked at her biographies. It's interesting. Some people say Jane Addams was a Quaker and others say that she was not. Her father identified himself sometimes as a Hicksite Quaker of a particular sect. And she always went to Sunday school and church as a child, but she never joined a church. And one of the things that she says later in her 20 years at Hull House was that a lot of the residents in the neighborhood who had no religion would come and ask her to officiate at their funerals because they felt that there was something there. And maybe it was her very international view of things that she would be a good person to officiate. Now, when she talks about that, she says she was surprised that happened, but it happened a number of times.
Well, she obviously had the religious training so she could at least articulate
yes.
the things that they needed on those occasions. At what point did she actually start actively applying things that would address her concerns having to do with what she had seen?
Well, it was after her second trip to Europe, which I think was a very long trip. Her stepmother and her sisters, she decided that if she was going to do something and she wanted to do something for the poor, that she was going to have to make up her mind. Right now, she couldn't just spend all of her time traveling around and not making that decision. So she did go to Toynbee Hall, and Toynbee Hall was a settlement. It was a settlement in London, and it was made up of young men who had graduated from Oxford. And their whole idea was to share their educational advantages with the people living in the neighborhood and also to have educational opportunities there for the poor, because it was a very poor neighborhood they were living in, and also work at social reform. And sometimes the settlement movement has been accused of being rather condescending.
I can imagine.
Yes. Yeah. And for these very well-educated young men and women to move into a very poor neighborhood, and a lot of times, certainly in the United States, where you had a lot of immigrants who didn't speak English, and to do good.
Teach them to read a little Ruskin or something.
Yes. And Jane Addams was definitely a very big fan of Ruskin. So she decided to come back to the United States and do this. And one of her responses to going to Toynbee Hall was, and I'm quoting here, and she wrote a letter to her sister Alice, and she said, "It is so free of professional doing good, so unaffectedly sincere, and so productive of good results in its classes and libraries, so that it seems perfectly ideal." So she went into this whole idea of purchasing a home and making a settlement without a lot of time thinking about it.
And she didn't have then the theological angle that many organizations of the time would have had. She was strictly interested in a more immediately material well-being. Mm-hmm. And I suppose the idea would be that some kind of general spiritual well-being would be the second result.
Right. She bought this house. It was the Hull Mansion in Chicago.
And when you say bought, is she wealthy at this point with inherited wealth?
Yes. After she graduated from college, her father died, and that was quite a loss to her. And he left his biological children and his stepchildren fairly well off. She certainly didn't inherit millions like some of the people of the day, the very, very rich people. But she inherited enough that she really wouldn't have to work the rest of her life, that she would have some kind of support, monetary support. And when she found this mansion, and it's called a mansion if you've ever been to the Hull House, the house itself, it's really not that big, and certainly not big as compared to some of the huge mansions in Chicago that were at that time. She found this house, and she actually rented it before she bought it.
And where is this house in Chicago?
Oh, it's at Halstead and Polk Street. It's in the very poor area where immigrants, when they used to come to Chicago, that was sort of their landing spot. So it was on the near west side of Chicago. So the first group of immigrants were the Irish and German and Bohemian. And then later, when she moved into Hull House, the Hull Mansion, there were a lot of Eastern Europeans and Southern Europeans. So there were a lot of Italians, Greeks, and Eastern European Jews, mainly from Poland and from Russia.
And what was her strategy? I mean, it's one thing to buy this nice
yes.
big house,
yes.
and then the first 4 or 5 or 10 Irish fill it up, and then sometime with some criteria, you have to move them along so you can bring in the next group.
Okay. The people who actually moved into Hull House were not the neighbors. The people who moved into Hull House were people like Jane Addams and Ellen Gates Starr, who also was the sort of the co-founder of Hull House. The people who lived in the house were like Jane Addams. Originally, they were all women. They were young. They were very well educated. Many of them had PhDs. And they were the first women of their generation to go on to higher education. And so the people who moved in were the reformers. And so the people that they served were the people in the neighborhood surrounding a
Hull
House.
So they would go out and minister somehow to
the Right. people. What she said when she opened this house, and she said Hull House was soberly opened on the theory that the dependence of classes on each other is reciprocal, and that as the social relation is essentially a reciprocal relation, it gives a form of expression that has peculiar value. So the whole idea was that we will give and they will give. They will learn and we will learn. And she hadn't really thought it out, I don't think, much further than that. And this could have been a disaster. I was just reading something that said Jane Addams was the founder of the settlement movement in the United States. Well, no, she wasn't. Hull House was probably the third settlement house in the United States, and it was patterned again after Toynbee Hall in London. She was very much a part of the settlement movement and certainly the most famous, but it was not the first.
And to count as a settlement, then it would be a place where the social workers, the activists, would be living there, but not the people they served.
Exactly.
And then it really functions as kind of a neighborhood center.
It's very much like a neighborhood center. I think if you look today and say, what are the settlements today? There are some places today that do call themselves settlements where people are living among the poor. There aren't too many, and some of them are religious based, but still doing sort of social reform. So when the women moved in, and she attracted women from all over the country, very well-educated women, some of them had jobs, but they would do volunteer work in the evening in their free time. So it was an exciting time for those women who didn't feel that there were any other opportunities open to them, and they really wanted to do social reform, and that was the place to do it.
So they would go out and distribute food and clothing, and how did they – or what did they do, and how did they decide exactly whom to minister to?
Yeah, it's very interesting because they didn't really distribute. That's one of the misconceptions. Yeah, but Hull House, and that lasted for years, is what does Hull House really do? One of the very first things was Ellen Gates Starr. It sounds naive. She decided to have a literature discussion class on George Eliot, and there were people who did
just
who
the
did
thing
come.
To warm you up, you know, right? On a cold
middle,
night.
Middle March, a nice short book.
So anyway, but it didn't take them too long to see that this was not the priority of the neighborhood. And so the very first thing they did was open a kindergarten.
Which was still a rather a novel idea.
Oh, yeah. I think it was the first program in Chicago. I think it was the first program, kindergarten program in Chicago. So they opened, and this was in the Hall Mansion itself, which they said is not that spacious. And so they opened this kindergarten. But it didn't take them very long to realize that what was really needed also was childcare. That a lot of the immigrant mothers also worked outside the home and needed to work outside the home. And Jane Addams talks at one point where some of the children in the neighborhood would just kind of wander down to Hull House, and they would just wander in and play in the bedrooms of the people who lived there, and whoever was happened to be around would kind of watch, you know, take care of them. And then they realized they needed something a little more formal with these young children just kind of wandering around. So they did open up a daycare center for working mothers.
And what sort of attitude toward the poor did these women have?
You know, it probably differs by each woman.
Well, and in the case of Jane Addams herself, since we're talking about her, how did she see the poor? Did she see them as poor through no fault of their own? Did she see them as, I don't know, how did she approach the people she was working with?
At that time, the kind of charity in Hull House was not a charitable organization, but the kind of charity that was available to the poor generally divided the poor into the worthy and unworthy. And so based on just personal sorts of habits or a lifestyle. And Jane Addams never saw that. In fact, that's why she was so happy that this was not like the organized charities where you divide the poor. Jane Addams has been accused of being condescending at times, and perhaps because this was a very new experience for her, living among the poor to begin with and then among all of these immigrants. I don't see – and when I read what she has to say, I see her looking at the structural – causes of poverty and not personal failures. And personal failures had come from our old poorhouse thinking that people were poor because of personal failures and that's why they ended up in poorhouses. And Jane Addams rejected that. And I think that's why the women became social reformers, because they saw that if they were going to deal with poverty, they were going to have to make some significant changes in laws and the whole structure.
So what were the options? What were the social network possibilities for poor people prior to the establishing of Hull House in Chicago?
Well, most of them had jobs. They worked very long hours in very unsafe conditions and didn't get paid very much. And it was certainly at the will of the employer. Before Hull House, there was some attempt at forming labor unions. But that wasn't always successful. And Haymarket happened, the Haymarket incident where the workers were demonstrating
riots, yeah.
And somebody threw a bomb and killed some police officers. That happened a few years before Hull House was
83,
yeah. Yeah, I think it was. And Hull House was established in 1889. So it was a few years before that. So there certainly was a lot of union activity among the workers.
But in terms of any kind of a social support network –
it was pretty much self-help, I think, through their own groups. There might be a church that might be part of that where everybody would go, some sort of a religious organization that would hold people together, because she does talk about a Catholic priest bringing a young Italian girl who was being abused by her husband, and they did give her shelter for a while. And so – or a rabbi coming and being concerned. So people would either gather with each other, but there really weren't very many meeting or public meeting places, and that's one of the things that Hull House provided, and just help out each other.
And what did the city of Chicago think of her?
Well, she was very much involved with politicians, and sometimes not in a very amicable way, because she was always pushing. And the one person that they really didn't like in that district, her neighbors and the women at Hull House, did not like their ward boss because he gave out jobs as sort of political plums. And one of the jobs that he gave out, which seems kind of strange, as a political plum was the trash inspector, the garbage inspector. And the garbage inspector would go around and make sure that the garbage men, and they were men at that time, picked up all the garbage. And they had a very filthy neighborhood with dead horses in the streets as well as just trash. And they were very concerned about how that affected young children, particularly with the disease. So Jane Addams applied for the job of garbage inspector. And she actually got it, which surprised everyone. And so she would go out and she would follow the garbage men around and making sure they did their job, which they did. And after a while, because of all her travels and things, she did turn it over to somebody else at Hull House, but it was a civil service job. And it was the only job she ever had in terms of being paid. She never took a salary for being head of Hull House because she was independently wealthy.
So she didn't actually have to go out and beat the bushes for financial support, didn't have to write grants or go out and push doorbells.
Well, she had to try to get financial support because Hull House started building buildings, because it was just a mansion, which, again, it's called the Hull Mansion. It's not that large. They started building buildings. The first building they built was – the downstairs was a reading room. The upstairs was an art gallery. And again, thinking that these were the things that the neighborhood needed. And then by 1908, which was not – too long of a period of time after they were established, they had 13 buildings. So Hull House, when we talk about it, we're really talking about 13 buildings.
It's a huge
complex. Yes. Yes. So she did have to beat the bushes for donors. And she found some very wealthy women in Chicago who for many years, including Charles Hull, who had owned the Hull Mansion, including the niece of Charles Hull, who was a big financial backer.
More on the life and work of Jane Addams when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. Jane Addams made speeches about the needs of the neighborhood, raised money, convinced young women of well-to-do families to help, took care of children, nursed the sick, listened to outpourings from troubled people. By its second year of existence, Hull House was host to 2,000 people every week. That's from the biography of Jane Addams on the Nobel Prize website. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Judith Sikora, and we're talking about the pioneering figure Jane Addams and her work in Chicago. We sort of set up Hull House here, and you've got the 11 buildings. What other kinds of programs does she get going? You mentioned the kindergarten. Mm-hmm. What else? If I am a neighbor, I'm a poor immigrant nearby, and I walk into Hull House, what do I find?
Well, you can find a lot of things. She mentions that there was activity from early in the morning till late at night. And, of course, with the kindergarten and the child care center, Hull House established the first public baths in Chicago, and because there was no place for people to just become clean. And it was a very dirty neighborhood because not only did they have tenements, they also had factories there. They established the first playground for children, the outdoor playground, because they were playing in the street, which was obviously very dangerous, plus not very safe for their health. The first public gymnasium, the first women's basketball team, and one of the Chicago papers praised that was the team to beat because nobody could beat these.
This all sounds so modernistical all of a sudden, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it does.
But when you say first basketball team, you mean in Chicago, first
yes.
women's basketball
yes,
team
in Chicago.
Was Jane Addams modeling this kind of list of activities after Toynbee Hall or after somewhere else?
They probably didn't play much basketball over there.
Probably not. I think what she did, and I think she finally, even in her idealism, of just started looking at the neighborhood to see what was needed. And people would approach her. There was a men's social science club that wanted to meet there, and they wanted to bring in speakers about sort of mainly they wanted to look at politics and bring in speakers. So that was something that was established because these men had approached her. And when you have 13 buildings and then there's room for other activities. So they had ethnic nights where there was the Greek women's chorus would come and sing and it sort of entertain each other. And they had a theater group. They put on plays. Then they actually established a music and art school because people like to look at nice pictures, but wouldn't it be nice to be able to do this yourself? So there was one woman who taught art there for many, many, many years, and I don't think she even lived at Hull House. She lived in the community, and she volunteered to do this, and she taught art there for children and adults. They had the adult education classes because people really wanted to move up. They didn't want to be in these factories for the rest of their lives. And they had citizenship naturalization classes. They had a coffee house, which became this sort of the social center of the neighborhood. And she mentions that a lot, which is kind of funny. Again, it's so it's pretty modern to have
Yes. They
have this coffee house. And it was actually patterned after an English pub. And that was one of the places where they also did some of their naturalization classes. I've seen a picture of all these people sitting in this coffee house and they're getting for the naturalization class. And then she brought in speakers from all over the world. Anybody who would come to Chicago, she would bring them in and have them speak. And so she had Frank Lloyd Wright. She had John Dewey, who was the educational philosopher, who's a very good friend of hers. So she had a lot of people come and speak at Hull House, and it did bring out a lot of people.
Are people starting to pay attention to Hull House? In other words, when does it sort of get on the map?
I think it gets on the map pretty early on. I don't think she was in business for more than maybe 3 or 4 years, and once she started building these other buildings and could put in more programs, people did start talking about it, and she did get a lot of donors. But she was also seen as this sort of angel to the poor and doing these not very controversial programs, and kindergarten, a gym, gymnasium, visiting nurses, those.
Well, what about health and birth control, for example?
One of the people who lived there for quite some time was Dr. Alice Hamilton, and she was very concerned about health. And the neighborhood around Hull House became a living laboratory. A lot of women who had advanced degrees, like Alice Hamilton, who was an MD, came there to study the neighbors and to look at health problems. So Alice Hamilton did all sorts of things in terms of looking at typhoid fever. There was an epidemic of typhoid fever and seeing what could be done about that. They did an investigation of cocaine use in the neighborhood. They were looking at why were so many children getting sick And so they would investigate. So they would have all these records so that they, when they went before legislative bodies, they could give these reports and say, here's what's happening. And they did get through some legislation and certainly some industrial safety legislation where people were working around very harmful chemicals and were becoming ill. So Illinois really started passing a lot of the laws in industrial safety to be able to help workers. But it was because the people at Hull House had the specifics about what was really going on.
Well, it was the era, wasn't it, of the so-called muckrakers were all not just social reform, but
it was a progressive era, yeah.
Yes, health reform, labor reform was really taking hold.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds as if she came along right as that wave was starting to crest.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Because I think that period, when we look at the progressive era and you had settlement houses, there ended up to be about 300 settlement houses in the United States. So it was a movement, most definitely, and all pretty much patterned that way in terms of educated people living in poor neighborhoods and doing a lot of social reform and doing a lot of studying of conditions. And so that progressive era, there was a lot going on and up until World War I, which seemed to change a lot of what was going on.
And is Hull House at this point just considered a sort of private foundation? Is it – I mean, because it's not government supported.
No,
it's
not
at
all.
Church-based.
No.
So
it was private.
Just a private charity?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because Jane Addams was the president of the National Conference on Charities and Corrections, and that involved people who were in organized charity that I talked about before, but also in the settlements, although they were late coming in because the organized charities didn't look too kindly upon settlements because settlements weren't looking at worthy and unworthy poor, and they were too open, I guess, for the organized charities. But at that time, there was a belief that charity should be done privately, that government should not be involved at all.
Well, there is an advantage, though, isn't there, in that if you're paying the bills, you can make the decisions and you can make things, rightly or wrongly, you can make things happen more quickly.
One of my students brought that up when we were talking about Hull House and all the things that happened at Hull House and all the lobbying they did and all the labor union organizing they did and just the work of trying to get rid of the local ward boss, that people couldn't do that today if they were receiving any kind of government funding.
Too political.
And so that couldn't be done. But I'm not sure if undertaking like Hull House could be done today either without government funding, because if you look at any sort of private nonprofit, they get government funding somewhere.
Well, it's so much more complicated now.
It's very complicated,
than
yes.
it would have been just in terms of the liability. Even.
Oh, yes.
But so many other criteria now that you have to follow to be legal.
Yes. And none of that was there at the time of Hull House. The Hull House Association still exists today and does run and does provide social services in Chicago, but it also receives government funding as well as private donations. And the mansion itself is a museum.
Do we know what sort of impact Hull House and its philosophy had on some of the people that came through its doors?
In Jane Addams' writing, particularly in the 20 years at Hull House, but also in a book she wrote called Peace and Bread in Time of War, she just gives little stories. And one of my favorites is very early on in Hull House, probably in the 1890s, that an elderly woman who was 90 years old was brought to Hull House because her daughter had left her alone all day in their apartment because the daughter had to work to support them. And the woman had developed this persistent habit of pulling the plaster off the walls. And so after a while, no landlord would rent to her. And she was seen as this troublesome woman in the neighborhood and certainly among the landlords. So they brought her to Hull House, and probably the only option they would have had if they had followed sort of traditional organized charity methods at that time would have put her into a home for the indigent elderly, which would have been essentially a poorhouse. But at Hull House, they decided to teach her how to make paper chains. And so they taught her this, and she really enjoyed this. So instead of pulling the plaster off the walls, she started making these paper chains and decorating the apartment with the chains.
So it's kind of an alternative.
Right. And today we would probably call it generalist social work. But another thing they found out about this woman was that she could speak Gaelic. And after one or two professors came to visit her because of this, because of her gift, which was discovered at Hull House, Jane Addams writes that the neighborhood was filled with pride that such a wonder lived in their midst. So it was taking this woman, looking at her strengths, and not only teaching her an alternative, but having the neighbors ended up having a very different view of her.
Hmm. And what about people who came through Hull House? I mean, were there detractors, those who came in and didn't like the way they were treated?
I don't really have evidence of that, although I did read a piece where a woman had come there to live and didn't like it at all. But there was an instance during the First World War, and we know that Jane Addams was vilified during the First World War because of her pacifism. But there was a draft office at Hull House, and she calls this the most poignant moment during the war. And she was walking past the draft office and a young man who was a Southern Italian man who she knew many of the Southern Italians had come to the United States to escape. To escape military service and to seek freedom of other sorts. And so she was watching the workmen coming through this line, because they were mainly workers, to register for the draft. And she was confronted by one of these workers who was from Italy, and she had just previously delivered a speech to the citizenship classes for the people who had just gotten their first papers. And then he said to her, and I'm quoting here that she wrote in her book, Peace and Bread in Time of War, "I really have you to thank if I am sent over to Europe to fight. I went into the citizenship class in the first place because you asked me to. If I hadn't my papers now, I would be exempted." And she said, "I could only reply that none of us knew what was going to happen and that maybe it might be some comfort to him that he would be fighting on the side of Italy." But she said, "The incident did not add to my peace of mind."
And did Jane Addams start feeling that it was almost a Band-Aid approach? In other words, if you're working with poverty, the results of poverty, I would think it would be hard not to get involved in trying to fix the causes of it. Did she start getting involved in political campaigns, in efforts to change the way capitalism worked? Or
she certainly got involved with the Progressive Party when Theodore Roosevelt was running for president in the Progressive Party, and because of his stand on social reform and also his stand on women's suffrage, as she gave the seconding speech to his nomination at the Progressive Party convention. So she did get involved in politics very directly in terms of being a part of a political party. But it's interesting because she said she didn't really like the word lobbying. She was talking about the first time they went to lobby in Springfield, I guess, to talk to the legislature about some of this factory legislation, about some of this child labor legislation, hours of work. I mean, they were talking about things in the progressive era like old age pensions and unemployment compensation and the 8-hour day and restrictions on child labor. All of these things they were talking about before it became part of the New Deal, and she died in 35, so she really missed a lot of the New Deal. But Frances Perkins, who was FDR's Labor Secretary, did spend some time at Hull House, so she was also and a social worker, and she was also involved in FDR's administration. So she saw it, I think, always, or pretty much always, on the big picture side, that you cannot end poverty without first education, which she pushed very hard and offered all those classes. That's on the individual level, but also all this other factory legislation and other legislation that much is what we take for granted today.
In terms of just dealing with a group of people, though, it seems kind of like a job for Sisyphus in a way, because the population of Chicago had to have been exploding during those years. How could she hope to keep up with it?
Well, I think she was pretty much zeroing in on her own neighborhood, and I don't know in terms of numbers how many that was and what she actually considered her own neighborhood. At one point, she says something about 36 nationalities. So, yes, I mean, I think it would be overwhelming. She sometimes will speak about that, or she'll sometimes speak about being saddened, but she just still kept going on. And I think that that's – I mean, I think she was so inspirational to everyone around her because everyone else, the people who lived at Hull House – and some people only came and maybe stayed a year, some people maybe 6 months. But they would come and they would study and see what needed to be done, and then they would lead and start all these new kinds of activities that would help not only individually people but overall.
At what point do we see in her thinking, now we're really starting to make a difference and there's something – permanent, maybe, that we can point to?
I'm not sure if she ever gets to the point where saying this, because, as I said, she died in 35 before a lot of the things she was lobbying for ever became law in the federal law. I mean, certainly they saw some victories in the Illinois legislature. And some things like the 8-hour day then ended up being declared unconstitutional. And so a lot of things that they were able to do got knocked down by the courts.
But on a case-to-case basis, there must have been a lot of satisfaction. Just what individual people that she dealt with.
Oh, she gives all kinds of wonderful examples. And it's really hard to pick out one of my favorite things. And whether or not this really changes the whole structural picture, but one of the things that she was very concerned about, and she was very concerned about immigrants, and she was very sympathetic with all the problems that they had. And one of the things she noticed is that the children of immigrants were, as happens today, they were becoming Americanized and they were becoming embarrassed by their parents and their parents' old ways. And so she tried to figure out, how can we get their own children to really appreciate the parents and what they had done? And so she came up with the idea of a labor museum. And just, she said, we found in the neighborhood at least 4 varieties of primitive methods of spinning and 3 distinct variations of the same spindle in connection with wheels. And so she was able to put this together into historic sequence and order to connect the whole with the present method of factory spinning. So they had the children working in factory spinning, but there was this whole history in the world of spinning. And so she set aside on Saturday nights in one of the buildings in Hull House, she said, within one room, a Syrian woman, a Greek, an Italian, a Russian, and an Irish woman enabled even the most casual observer to see that there is no break in orderly evolution if we look at history from the industrial standpoint, that industry develops similarly and peacefully year by year among the workers of each nation, heedless of differences in language, religion, and political experiences. So she said, and then we grew ambitious and brought in lecturers. But how she says that this actually, that she felt was really a victory in the sense that this worked and some of the things that she wanted to do was, she said, I recall a certain Italian girl who came every Saturday evening to a cooking class in the same building in which her mother spun in the Labor Museum exhibit. And yet Angelina always left her mother at the front door while she herself went around to the side door because she did not wish to be too closely identified in the eyes of the rest of the cooking class with an Italian woman who wore a kerchief over her head, uncouth boots, and short petticoats. One evening, however, Angelina saw her mother surrounded by a group of visitors from the School of Education who much admired the spinning, and she concluded from their conversation that her mother was the best stick spinner in America. And then 2 things happened after this. Jane Addams says that Angelina no longer went into a different door than her mother. She came into the door of her mother, and that her mother finally pulled out from under the bed all of these things that she had made in Italy and had brought them to the United States that her daughter had considered too uncouth, and she was able to bring these out.
So ethnic pride.
Yeah, and she worked very hard. Jane Addams talked a great deal about immigrant gifts. She saw people, and today we talk about strengths-based social work, but she was talking about it then, of not seeing immigrants as people who should be, quote, completely Americanized, assimilated, but more of a bicultural, that people bring all these wonderful gifts, like the Labor Museum, to display these gifts, and that people shouldn't give up their arts and crafts, their traditions from their other country.
And their pride.
And so she's viewed people very much like that.
And what about her own family life or personal life? I mean, it sounds as if she's making all the people coming into the Hull House sort of her big extended family. But did she have a life separate from that?
She did. I mean, she was very close to her brothers and sisters, and she speaks about writing to them and visiting them And they all live fairly close because she was in Chicago, and the ones who lived around Cedarville, that she would be able to see them. She doesn't talk a lot about them in 20 Years at Hull House because she's talking about Hull House, but she does mention. And then she's had nieces and nephews come and stay at Hull House and to visit her there. And she certainly stayed in contact with her stepmother. So she did have a happy family life. And was very much admired by her nieces and nephews. That was pretty clear in one of the biographies I read.
We're going to talk about Jane Addams other than Hull House when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Washington Island Ferry at the tip of Door County, providing year-round transportation across storied Death's Door Passage. Schedule information, visitor highlights, and more is on the web at wisferry.com.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Judy Sikora. And we've been talking about Jane Addams, who was a major force in social reform in the United States beginning in 1889 or so and continuing for, well into the 1930s. It does seem inevitable if Jane Addams and company are going to be out dealing so closely with so many people from so many places that she would inevitably see that you can find people intelligent enough and informed enough to vote anywhere, and that she would inevitably become involved in the women's suffrage movement. Did she indeed? And if so, how far did she carry it?
Well, she started giving speeches in around 1897, and she gave a lot of speeches in the West. And one of the things that concerned her about women's suffrage, because obviously with all the work they were doing at Hull House, most of which they did before the women had the right to vote, and a lot of the legislation that they were lobbying for, she was very concerned about some of the suffragists were looking down upon what they call ghetto women. And there were some of them, some leading suffragists who would say, well, maybe we should have a literacy test before that we would let all women vote. And so Jane Addams wrote a very sharp article really poo-pooing that whole idea of all of her experience with immigrants and how certainly that they were more than qualified because here were women who lived in these neighborhoods who knew a lot about what needed to be done to make life better and that they were very well educated in that sense and certainly should be given the right to vote along with other women. So she did back off from that sort of elitist part of the suffrage movement. And there was a section of the suffrage movement that was fairly elitist.
And after they got the right to vote in 1920 and so on, and she continues to be a reformer. Well, I guess looking at all her work, what would you say got her in the most trouble, the most criticism? Mm-hmm. I mean, any pioneer is going to run into, into opponents.
Well, probably there were two. One was the big issue of she was involved in labor union organizing at Hull House. The women's shirt makers, the women's cloak makers were both organized at Hull House. And she created this club called the Jane Club. They named it the Women in the Jane Club. And these were young working women who wanted to live in a cooperative so that when one of them lost a job because they were on strike or because they were just agitating too much at work, that they would have a place to live. They wouldn't have to worry about the wages. So Jane Addams gave them and had built for them a building for the Jane Club. And this was many of these young women living there who were not like the other Hull House residents. They were not highly educated. They were not well-to-do. And the Jane Club lived at Hull House. And so one donor, a lawyer and a businessman, wrote them a letter and said, if Hull House is to continue its usefulness, it seems to me that it should divorce itself from politics, religion, employers' associations, and trade unions. Until this time arrives, I do not think that Hull House is entitled to the support of the community. So that was one of the big things that really got her into trouble. But the thing that probably got her into the most trouble was that around 1915, she declared herself a pacifist. She said that she was not at all, and this was before the war actually started, that she was not at all for the world going to war. She lived in an area with all these immigrants from all these different countries, and she saw no reason why there should be a war. So that in 1915, first of all, in the United States, she organized the Women's Peace Party. And they met in New York, and they organized as this party. And a couple people from Hull House were part of that. But for the most part, people in Hull House were not pacifists like Jane Addams. And then this group of women from the United States went to The Hague and organized women from all over the world, including the ones from the belligerent countries. And they went to each of the countries that were either going to war or were in war, and tried to convince the heads of state not to go to war. And in 1919, they became the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and that's an organization that exists today. And Jane Addams was the first president. So she got herself into a lot of trouble because she was called a communist, she was called a traitor, because she was a pacifist and opposed to war. Although there was a draft office at Hull House where the polling place had been, and so people could come in and register for the draft.
And did the government scrutinize her the way, you know, later the FBI is going to be on people's cases that
right.
they suspect of?
Right. Well, they looked at Hull House, obviously, very carefully because you had all these different immigrants from countries that were fighting each other. And so she says in, I think this is the second 20 years at Hull House, and she says, "One Sunday afternoon I received a call from a man from the Secret Service Department who asked me if I knew that Bulgarian communists were holding a meeting in our largest public hall. I told him that I knew some Bulgarians were having a concert in Bowen Hall. What better could, quote, the alien enemy, end quote, do, I queried, than to spend a Sunday afternoon in a decent place listening to good music? He replied that his orders were to arrest the leaders, and he went back to the hall for that purpose. He returned in an hour to say that he couldn't find the leading communists, for no one had said a word. And because he was young and perplexed, he asked me what I would do in his place. I replied that I was afraid that I should return to headquarters and resign because I happen to feel very strongly in regard to arresting people without warrants. He answered that it wouldn't be necessary to resign because he would be fired fast enough. And she never again heard of his fate, but she was very happy that no one was arrested at Hull House during the First World War.
And would you say it was her pacifism that most of all led to the Nobel Peace Prize of 1931, or was it more the social work efforts with the Hull House?
She's always known as winning the Nobel Peace Prize in 1931, as you said, the first American woman to do that, for her work in the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. But the man who was giving out the award in his presentation speech also talked about her work at Hull House. And I think part of that, too, was because he had visited Hull House a couple of times. And so it was for both things, because she didn't see a difference. She saw that working with the poor and trying to make changes and structural changes and that whole idea of freedom leads directly to peace, is that you can't have one without the other. You have to address those issues of poverty in order to have peace. So she really didn't, in her own mind, I think, see a difference. It was a logical, for her, just a logical next step after working on social reforms.
I gather she was influential in inspiring Hull House-like facilities in other cities?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There were about, I think, 300 in the United States, and I think Toynbee Hall was sort of the first influence, but people would always come and visit Hull House because it did become the most famous, and I think it's because they really did probably more than other settlements. There are people, you know, Harry Hopkins, who worked in FDR's administration as the relief czar, was a product of a settlement house in New York. I mean, Eleanor Roosevelt taught dancing at a settlement house in New York. So settlements were a movement, but there were none like Hull House.
And did she become disillusioned? I would think it'd be hard to be an idealist because there'd be so many ways that you could feel disappointed.
I'm not sure she ever really became completely disillusioned. I think that she still, because when you read her her autobiographies, she comes up with these wonderful stories about individuals, and she seems to feel that great joy in that.
And do you get a sense of her personality, the kind of person she was, how she would speak, the kind of effect she had when she entered a room?
She's often described as being very quiet And I think she's one of those people sort of led from behind, that she would just sort of gently suggest things or talk about things, and people then would run and do it. One of the things in her management style, one of the reasons that one biographer thought that all these women gathered around, was that she was very democratic in her management style. She wouldn't give out orders and say, you do this and you do that. The clubs and all of the things that were happening at Hull House were pretty much run by themselves. If someone said, I really want to do a study on the effects of, you know, garbage in the street on young children, then that person would do that. They would live at Hull House. They would do that and write up reports and do some lobbying. And I just sort of got the idea that that was her personality, that she was not loud, and she was, I think, soft-spoken, and she has been described as Gentle Jane. I've seen that too, once in a very pejorative way from a leftist group that was upset that she wasn't going far enough. When she died, thousands of people came to Hull House, and I've seen pictures of it, and they said they got telegrams from the President of the United States, from the premiers of England and Canada, and from all countries in Europe, including Czechoslovakia, the President of Czechoslovakia, from Japan, from India. But they also got telegrams from the King of the Hobos, the Lady Garment Workers Union, the cooks, the waiters, and the waitresses unions, and even the bartenders union. And so I think that explains Jane Addams. And then another person wrote and said, but you could also see a few bootleggers and some other sort of career criminals who had lived in the neighborhood who loved Jane Addams but didn't quite fully get her message, but they were also there at this funeral. So I can just imagine this group of people. So I think she had a very strong feeling about democracy and what democracy meant.
And she did not make that distinction between the deserving and the undeserving.
Absolutely
poor.
Not. I think in social work, I think we get that wonderful legacy of her and looking at people's strengths rather than at a deficit model of building on people's strengths, that all people have something to give. And also just the whole social work methods of group work and community organization. I think we get that. But we also get that of women who could make a difference and did some wonderful things, and also the legacy of peace and how she tied those two things together, that you couldn't have all of this horrible poverty and also have peace, that you absolutely had to work on getting rid of poverty, and that was the only thing that was going to guarantee world peace.
Any thought on what she would say about current conditions?
Well,
methods. I've thought about that. And the one part where she said to the Secret Service agents that she would resign if she were him because she didn't believe in arresting somebody without a warrant, that really stuck out at me of her believing that. I think that she would be very much opposed to what's going on now. And I think she would be very shocked at the level of poverty we still have in this country. I think that would be a huge disappointment, because I think maybe, as you were saying, did she ever get discouraged? Things were starting to look up, even with the Depression. Things were starting to look up when you had Frances Perkins and Harry Hopkins, both social workers, working on these issues. And some of the things that they had been talking about for years were starting to become part of legislation. But she died before she saw all of that. I think maybe that she might have been looking up at that time. And, of course, this is before World War II, but I think today she would be shocked not only at war, but also at the level of poverty in the United States.
Our guest has been Judy Sikora, and we have been delving into the life and the career of Nobel Peace Prize laureate Jane Addams, who started it all in Hull House in Chicago. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.